Hello, and welcome to episode 235 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I want to start today's episode with something that may sound almost quaint. Back in 1988, Congress passed a law to protect the privacy of Americans' video rental records. The concern at the time was that someone might find out what movies you rented from Blockbuster. That feels almost charming now. Back then, we worried about shielding our VHS history. Today, entire companies are built on tracking what we watch, what we click, how long we pause, and sometimes even how much debt we carry. I'll also admit this. Not long ago, I was in the camp that said, if you're not doing anything wrong, why worry about being surveilled? That might have once been a reasonable view, but I don't think it's been true for some time. Because what we're seeing now isn't just surveillance for safety or even for advertising. It's surveillance as a business model, and increasingly as a tool for extraction. Rick, when do you think the internet stopped feeling like a helpful tool and start feeling like something designed to pull value out of us? And what does that shift mean for human dignity?
Well, I think that the shift started around the time that the word Google became a verb. You know, when we stopped just talking about a new search engine that came out, but we started using it to describe something we were doing on a daily basis. And it was around that time that we started seeing ads for products that would be based on things that we had searched for. And we realized, oh, they're collecting information on us about what we're searching for, and then they're trying to feed us certain results. And so, this had been going on for some time, but we started seeing evidence of it. And that's when I started hearing people talking about, what's going on with the internet and is it watching us? And then the other shift that happened is when Amazon's Alexa comes out and people start talking to Alexa and then start talking about, are they being listened to all the time? Because you're having a conversation and you say something that sounds like Alexa, and it speaks up to you. And then Apple comes out with their own name that I don't want to mention right now, right? And but if you say something like, yes, I'm being serious, you know, it would speak up and say, what do you want? Mm-hmm. Right. And this is where there's a shift to people saying, is everything we do being tracked now? And in some sense, yes. I will say this though, before AI, I was kind of in your camp thinking it doesn't really matter that there's records of all this stuff because nobody can go through all the vast amount for every person. But now we have the ability to crunch all kinds of data with AI. And so I think there's a much bigger concern, or at least awareness of we should be concerned.
You mentioned Google was kind of one of the inflection points when it sort of became the default search engine. And that's also the time where things like Facebook and Twitter were sort of spinning up. All those, you know, to do a Google search, to create a Facebook account, to go on and retweet and interact on Twitter, those were all popular, but also they were free. And that's when also many smart people said, if you don't pay for the product, you are the product. And I think that's something that people weren't thinking a lot of back then. I think increasingly are now. And I also, though, and this is where I used to struggle a little bit, because if you know, you're a young family that's just starting out and you're Googling things like, you know, how long does your a newborn need to sleep every night? And, you know, what exactly is colic? And, you know, what diapers are the best ones to when you have a 3-month-old? And you start Googling around those things. Well, maybe you'll start seeing ads for Pampers and for other cribs or whatever else young families need. And maybe that's useful, right? I mean, because you might be more interested in getting a coupon for diapers than you would be for a restaurant that you can't possibly go to right now because you have a newborn at home. So, I mean, there is some usefulness there, I guess. But then it does seem at some point that this turned into something that's the reason these and other large tech companies simply exist, right? Is they started off being useful ways to connect us with each other or ways to connect us with needed information, and really now in many cases exist just to track us and extract money from us. And that's like not great, but we're also, if I told you tomorrow you can't use the internet ever again, I mean, that wouldn't be good. So it feels like we're sort of at this point where I just don't know what we do about this, but there certainly is, I think the perception among many people that they're just sort of losing their dignity when they go online.
Yeah, so there's a... Dignity is one of the things that it's attached to. Our basic conceptions of dignity is this conception that there's a difference between our private self and our public self, and that we ought to have some control over what we make public about ourselves. And so, and this is the basic intuition behind the notion of like the ethical component of privacy is our right to determine what information other people know about us. And when you have a sharp line between the private and the public, you have some control over like when you're acting publicly, when you're acting privately, and you know that your private stuff is your own. And you can divulge some information about yourself if you wish to, but you don't have any obligation to do it. But here we are using the internet, we're doing Google searches, we're shopping for something, we're doing it in the privacy of our own home, and yet it's public data. And so suddenly the boundaries between public and private are just, they're just blown up, right? Like, what is public now? If the things that I'm doing in my own home are now public, do I control anything about the information that others know about me? And so when it comes to like protecting some kind of notion of the self, do I have any say in it? And this is where we come up to human dignity. It's like, what's the difference between a person and a thing? Well, like a person has rights. A person has some say over what other people can do. If you're a thing, you're just there to be manipulated and used. Well, if there's no distinction between the private and the public, if everything about us is public, that it can all be manipulated, then we have no dignity left. This is a pretty deep concern.
And you and I have been around long enough to remember life before Google and Facebook and really having even any real access to computers. I certainly did not in our home growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, and I'm guessing you did it either. So this is new for us, right? I mean, over the course of our lives. It would not surprise me, though, if you talk to young people who are 18 to 25. I mean, this has been their whole life. They do not know a time where they didn't have these products. And in some cases, didn't remember a time where they didn't have, like, smartphones around. And it would seem to me that young people would be less concerned about this than maybe you and I, but that doesn't maybe seem to be the case.
That's not the case. So when I talk to my own students, this has just in the last couple of years become a major concern. And so that led me to look into, like, what is the research on this? What are surveys showing us? 62% of people that are Gen Z, this is like college age people, they're very concerned about privacy and data privacy in particular. Around 40% of young people fall into a category that are called privacy actives. That means they're taking actual steps to control the information that companies can glean about themselves. They're much more engaged with this than people that are our age, for example, more engaged than any other generation. I was surprised by this too. I was thinking, the younger people are, the more they've grown up with this kind of technology, the more comfortable they are with it, the less they're concerned about privacy. And it turns out to be just the opposite.
And one thing, as I mentioned at the start of the show, I've sort of changed my opinion on this, and this didn't happen overnight. But one thing that really sort of gave me a reason to codify this position was a podcast I listened to recently on the Ezra Klein Show. And he had a couple of people on there talking about how the internet, frankly, has gotten worse. And it kind of turned into a discussion about privacy and surveillance online. But the one story that just stuck out to me during that conversation is one of them was talking about, and this I think especially happens in larger cities where there are a real scarcity of applicants for nurses. And a lot of times these large hospitals and large cities have the need for trying to find nurses in pretty quick in ways. And there's these apps that are designed where if you're a nurse who's looking for a job in one of these large cities, you can go onto this app and put in your qualifications and put all the information about you in. And then any of the healthcare institutions that subscribe to this app can go through and look and screen the applicants and find out who might be a good fit. Like, so far, none of that sounds like a big problem. But here's where it got weird. Is you are, when you're filling out this information, you provide enough information for this app to run a credit report on you. And I'm sure that there is some box you check as you're filling this out that like discloses that, but I'm sure it's also buried in like a bunch of 74 paragraphs of legalese that nobody really goes and reads. So why do they get this credit report on you? There were times where you heard stories where people with not so great credit may not have been looked upon as highly when they're job seeking because it may say things about your past or what have you. No, it's just the opposite here, in fact, because what this app does is it determines that if you have two equally qualified candidates, we'll call them Fred and Susie, and let's say Susie has a great credit report and she has like virtually no consumer debt, high credit score. Fred, however, has like a lot of consumer debt and a credit score that's not great. Well, instinctively, these apps know and these healthcare institutions know that Fred might be more eager and more incentivized to get a job like right now and may take that job for less money than Susie because Susie's not in such in desperate straits at the moment. And they'll look at that and say, we're going to offer this job to Fred. And in fact, we're going to offer that job at a little less money. And if he says no, well, maybe we'll go to Susie and offer her a little more. But we're pretty sure Fred looks like a desperate guy and he'll take this lowball offer. I mean, that's really bad, right?
Yeah. So this is something that we could say might have been done in the past where people know something about the candidates who are applying and speculate, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if you're like in a town of 5,000 people and you apply at the local hardware store. So
you're right. Yeah. But here we have something where we don't know what is going into the determination of people's wages, either the wages they're actually being offered or... And in many cases, the wages are changing day by day. So this is called algorithmic labor management, where all kinds of things, wages and other things are being handled according to these algorithms that are basically black boxes. So there's no transparency in what one is making or why. So you might sign some agreement, but you still don't know what's going into it. And companies like Uber and Lyft, DoorDash, Amazon, UPS, anybody who's employing people through the gig economy, they're using something like this. They're using these programs. I think it's a new thing, maybe kind of a revelation that we could have nurses being hired according to those kinds of algorithms. And then you start wondering, well, is this coming for all of us? And I think it indicates a real need for some new labor laws. Like we haven't had really significant changes in our labor laws for a long time. And now we've got this new technology that is that frankly is just exploiting people.
And in this case, exploiting the people who are most vulnerable, right? Is that, you know, in my example earlier, Fred may be offered the job at a low ball rate because he just seems desperate.
Yeah. And exploitation generally is practiced on those who are vulnerable for some reason or another. And in this case, it's vulnerability because of debt. It does not seem fair. Like, I don't think any of us would say, like, it's part of a just society that people who need more money should earn more less money for doing the same work. Generally, we say, like, what's fair in a society is equal pay for equal work. And this is not what's going on at all. And so, like, why not? Well, because we have no laws enforcing it.
And the other thing that was talked about on that show that, again, that it sort of fits under more of the surveillance topic, but it talked about those Amazon drivers. And our town and many towns across America are filled full of these, like, I guess there was kind of large vans that go around and deliver packages. And it doesn't surprise anyone, I'm sure, to know that Amazon sort of has an order saying this is the order in which you deliver the packages, but this is the most efficient. Like, that makes sense. You don't want somebody going from the north side of town to the south side of town, back to the north side of town. I mean, that doesn't make sense. But also, those vans are filled full of cameras where they're monitoring, like, how, you know, how quickly you respond, you know, your eye movements, your, you know, how you're sitting, how often you stop for bathroom breaks. There was a story where this woman had believed, at least, that she had, like, stopped too often for breaks because it was, frankly, her time of the month. So she went back to the back of the van to, like, take care of some things. And it was all caught on camera, you know, that she didn't know. And, like, all these, like, terrible invasions of privacy that, of course, I mean, a company as smart and lawyered up as Amazon has, I'm sure, disclosed all this deep inside some sort of long employment contract that does all this, because they're not going to, I mean, they're smart enough to know that if they don't tell their employees that there are cameras in their vehicles, that's opening them to litigation. So I'm sure they're covering themselves legally. But that there really is sort of this illusion of consent that so many people have, whether you're an Amazon employee, whether you're an Amazon customer, that there are all these things that we just sort of passively agree to because we want to get a job or because we want to get a package delivered to us quickly, that we just sort of don't care maybe about all those specific details. And it sort of seems like there's three places you can have a check on that. One, expecting each and all of us to become experts on reading through all those terms of service disclosures, and that seems like not great. Two, having the companies be responsible actors in this, and that seems like, well, not working. And three, to have a government in place that, like, looks out for people and tries to protect them, and that also does not seem to be working right now. Is there a solution here at all?
Well, eventually it'll be some kind of governmental regulation, and it has to be. This generally happens with the development of new technologies, as new technologies make possible practices that were not possible before and that we had not even anticipated. Once those practices become possible, exploitation takes place, and then you figure out, okay, how are people being harmed and what laws do we have to pass in order to regulate it so that we create some kind of basis or some kind of standard for behavior which does not allow for the worst forms of exploitation. And that's clearly what we need to do. It's why we have things like child labor laws, right? Is so that you don't have that kind of exploitation. We may not want overregulation, but we also don't want exploitation. And so we're trying to, you know, like, have a good balance between the two. And we're living at a time now where technologies are expanding so rapidly that we simply can't keep up with the pace of the change. And I think what we're going to see over the next 5 years or so are a lot of things that are really disruptive and exploitative in society. And that's going to cause major political upheaval, because instead of being able to like, one at a time, meaningfully address, like, judicious legislation, some of the things that we need to do to make our society more just, if we end up with massive exploitation of people so that like people get really upset, this is the sort of thing that leads to like extreme overreaction politically. It's, I think, why we find like so many young people now just reject capitalism completely as evil or as unjust. It's not because of capitalism as an economic system.
The local hardware store, for example.
Right. It's and I think capitalism as an economic system is responsible for like all kinds of progress and all kinds of benefit. But without regulation at certain points, it also allows for a great deal of exploitation. And we're seeing that now. It's going to get worse. And I really worry about revolutionary kind of actions in our political system as a result. What you would hope for then is like businesses come together and say, okay, we want to regulate ourselves so that you don't have that public overreaction that becomes really punitive towards business. But I don't think that's going to happen.
I just can't imagine that 5 or 10 years from now that we're going to be less of a digital society than we are now. And I don't know if 10 years from now, Amazon and Google will be some of the biggest and most profitable companies in our country. And I don't know if they're going to be, but if they're not, they'll be replaced by other ones that are.
Like NVIDIA or something.
Sure.
Right.
But I just can't see that anytime as we move into a more digitally connected world, it just seems like there are these sensors and surveillance apparatuses that large companies just can't help but help themselves to not use, right? Because there's somebody who's going to sit down and say, like, I'm sure whoever started delivering Amazon packages initially was just like, here's the packages, and maybe start on this side of town and go the other side of town, and you'll hopefully be done in 8 hours. And somebody, some consultant came in and said, well, we can like do this in a smarter way. And here's a piece of software we developed that sort of tracks this out so they can save time. And they're like, oh, that's great. What took 8 hours now takes 6. And then, well, we can also track this and track driver behavior. And that takes takes 6 hours and maybe takes 5.5. And well, that seems like good. And that saves time and money. And there are all these ways where we can measure everything that I just don't know what the incentive is for these companies to act in ways that aren't just boosting efficiency and boosting the bottom line. And so much, and again, that's on the employee side. And there's also, I'm sure, things that say if you send out 2 push alerts every day about the big sales on your e-commerce site, that generates more sales than just sending out 1. And we'll target those to people who expressed interest in this because of what we've seen in their social media back. I mean, so like there are all these incentives. I just don't know how you stop that.
Companies are pretty sensitive to where consumers or workers have real pushback and where they don't. And sometimes they misstep. So like a company, for example, you sign up to receive emails from a company and text alerts about sales and other promotions, and it's a place where you like to shop. But then they start sending you to like 2 notices a day. You're getting texts and emails, and then you
unsubscribe. And I've done that, and I'm sure you have too.
Absolutely. But then there's another one where you get a notice about once a week. And you say, okay, that's okay, because I like to know what's coming up with that company. And companies kind of figure this out.
Yeah.
The ones that overdo it, then they self-correct, right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it was funny you mentioned that, because I signed up for the other day. I was looking at a product. And I'm like, oh, I might be interested in this someday. And then it was like, sign up to learn more. And I'm like, oh, boy. But it said, and I'm taking them at their word, we send 1 email a month, letting you know about our, like, oh, well, I can handle 1 email a month. So, I mean, that's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Versus like 3 or 4 a day.
Yeah. And then some companies say, like, you can choose how often you want to be notified. And so, okay. So you can handle that. But you get the same thing with workers. So one of the things that many companies are doing is they're really tracking carefully employee engagement scores. And these are metrics, and they're measuring them sometimes quarterly, sometimes annually. And they find out, like, so they start doing keystroke tracking on everybody, and people really hate it. And they start trying to find ways of working around it and so forth. And they find that in certain key areas, productivity is going down and engagement is going down. So here they thought it would be something that increases efficiency. It might, except people hate it so much, it ends up worsening efficiency. And so they self-correct and say, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to try something else.
But that something else might be...
It could be something worse or something that we don't know about.
Or could be just, we'll automate you out of a job.
It could be.
Like, you know, I mentioned these Amazon trucks that drive around our city. If Amazon is as popular or more popular 10 years from now, I would be shocked to know that there are still as many drivers driving around as many vans around as many cities, because even though the package volume may be high, if not higher in the future, a lot of that is probably going to be automated. And it does, you do have to kind of balance that. Well, you know, if people complain loud enough, they'll just find ways to get robots there, because robots don't complain much at all.
So here's what keeps me hopeful. We started out this show as talking like one of the ways in which we move from something that's like innocent to something that violates human dignity is when you start treating people as things
and products
and not as people. When people are not treated as people, like, we react against that and we don't like it. And this is one of the things that, like, with the new technologies, it always enters into our social life in some way. And we are not just things that have automatic reactions the way that objects do. We think and then we respond to how we're being treated. And so you start seeing trends go in a certain direction, and then people have a reaction. They think about it. They talk to one another and they say, we don't like this. We like something else better. Let me give you a very simple example. 20 years ago, everybody was convinced Amazon is putting bookstores out of business. And that's what we saw for about a 10-year period. For the last 10 years, independent bookstores have doubled in this country. Why? Because they've reinvented themselves as event places and as gathering places. It turns out that people really want that. And I think that this is the way in which, like, as human beings participating in society, we're always doing that. We, you know, we can talk about technology, but at the end of the day, technology has to work to make us feel better about our lives. Otherwise, we reject it. So as long as we're using phones to be able to connect with people, to do things better, like to get around, to find directions, and it works really well, as soon as it starts manipulating us in ways that make us feel less human or that we're being deceived or used, it's a fine line there. At some point we say, like, we don't want this anymore. I'm not saying we're going to give up on our phones altogether, but we might start saying, like, I don't want certain kinds of programs. I don't want certain functions on my phone, or I'm not going to use it as much. And so technology is always adapting to people's deep desire to be treated as people.
But I also worry that technology, at least some parts of it, are also constantly adapting to make us more addictive to their product. And I think that's probably more in the social media space than it is in, like, mapping. I mean, I don't think people probably sit on their phone for 8 hours a day saying, how long does it take me to drive to Trenton, New Jersey? Like, I'm going to find out how many detours there are. I mean, that seems like weird. But we all know that there are things like TikTok and Instagram, et cetera, where they are, you know, some would even say they're using some of the same addictive principles that cigarette companies were accused of and really were doing back in the 90s, right? And where they would sit there and stand in front of Congress and say, no, no, sir, we're not doing any of this. But they knew all along that they were creating an addictive product. That is a little bit different to me, and why I think this is a different thing than maybe a little bit what you just said.
Well, yes, but now we have schools. Most schools in the country have either passed bans or they're considering bans against cell phones in the schools. Australia just passed a ban on social media companies under the age of 16. I talk to a lot of young people right now that say they're really limiting their social media usage. Said they don't like it, you know, as much as previous generations. And so that's the way in which we adjust to the overreach. Now, like, what's going to happen long term? I don't know. Either you self-regulate or you get, we'll have kind of meaningful government regulation about a lot of this stuff having to do with privacy.
Just a quick note, shortly after this podcast was recorded, CBS News announced it was severing ties with Peter Attia, who is the focus of our dilemma segment.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, what is your question for me?
Well, Scott, about 6 months ago, I started listening to Dr. Peter Attia's podcast called The Drive. Attia is a longevity expert who was recently featured on 60 Minutes. In late January, when the latest release of the Epstein files came out, it was discovered that there were several emails from Attia to Jeffrey Epstein. They don't prove that he engaged in criminal conduct, but some of them are quite graphic and even disgusting, and they suggest an ongoing social relationship between the two. So here's my question to you. I'm following Peter Attia's podcast because I think it gives some pretty good health advice. I find it informative and interesting. Should I unfollow his podcast? I'm not paying for it. I don't subscribe to the paid version, but I am like one of the subscribers to it. For ethical reasons, should I unfollow that podcast?
I'll take probably an unpopular position here a little bit, and it kind of relates on what we talked about in the first part of today's show. First of all, I don't know if you've done this, but you can. There's a database where you can go in and search the Epstein files.
Really?
Yes. So just because you mentioned that the host of this gentleman, Peter Attia, am I saying his name right?
I think it's Attia, but okay. It could be Attia. Yeah.
So,
I think it might be Attia.
So I decided before I pass judgment on him, I should make sure that we're not in the Epstein files. So I did run us through. We are not in the Epstein files. So those people listening who may be worried, should they continue to subscribe to The Ethical Life, Rick and I are not there.
I think that's partly because we don't have real common names. But if you have a common, like Mike Johnson, might be in the Epstein files.
Yeah, that's true. But we are not. So there is that. So here, and I mean, I don't want to turn this into a whole long debate about the Epstein files and this whole thing. Because I certainly want to come down on the side that Jeffrey Epstein was a terrible human being and did despicable things and did many, many illegal things. And the justice system should have taken notice of this much sooner and been more deliberate in how it prosecuted him. And all that is, I think, undoubtedly true. What does worry me a little bit in these grand calls by almost everybody to release the Epstein files and continue to release even more is that and that's why in a lot of, this is a long, huge case that has, millions and millions of documents, right? And most cases aren't this big. But anytime you're investigated by the FBI, a file is generated, right? And you don't usually release those. Why? Because it includes all sorts of information in there that is not criminal oftentimes and links people to other people who may be associates, may be friends, may be just passing acquaintances and kind of puts them because of their attachment with this person makes those people sound guilty of things that they didn't otherwise do. Now, I have not read the details on this fella, but it does sound like he was more than a passing acquaintance with Jeffrey Epstein. But I'm also going to assume that if he were doing things or found to be doing things that were directly associated with criminal activity, there would be they would pursue this more. And it sounds like what you're telling me is that from everything you know, is that he engaged in some graphic and disgusting commentary with this Epstein man, but none of this was criminal conduct. So I guess part of me, and why this kind of goes back to our earlier discussion about privacy, I just worry that there is sort of this expectation now going forward that, like, if you are caught dealing with someone who's convicted of a crime, that you're somehow also guilty of some crimes. And it's tough. It's like what you said. I mean, I didn't read through the files, but that it sounds like he did some and said some pretty awful things back and forth, and said things that I'm sure would rather not have come out. If every email I've ever written in my life was like put on a website, I'm sure people could comb through it and come up with things that I would have just as soon not said. Again, I hope nothing as bad as maybe what he did, but like, I think we do have some sort of expectation of privacy. And so I guess in sort of a broad stroke, I worry a little bit about people, high profile people like this and others who had an unfortunate and probably ethically wrong relationship with Epstein have gotten like real world consequences for this, even though they didn't do anything to break the law. So I want to stop there before I go further. Do you disagree with my point I've made so far?
I agree in general with it, like in most cases. And I think, you know, this is part of what we call cancel culture, Lutzen. Like,
yeah,
it overreacts to things, and especially guilt by association.
Harvey Weinstein was convicted of crimes and did awful things, and he like should be canceled, right? I mean, he's like a real bad guy. But if you were like his neighbor who had Harvey over to dinner parties a couple times, like, what does that mean?
Right. And I guess, so then you have to kind of look. So if he has emails with him before, with Jeffrey Epstein, before he's convicted of the sex crimes, and even if some of them are like off color or not the best language, I think that's one thing. And you kind of say, okay, you give him a pass. If it's after the conviction, and then you're joking about sex with somebody who's a convicted sex offender, I'm not sure that's so excusable.
That's where
I would draw the line, and that's what we're talking about here.
Oh, I think it's bad, but I also would also say that it also bothers me, and maybe I'm the only person who's bothered by this, that like that was disclosed, because I just don't think he did anything
because
illegal.
I think you're right about that. That bothers me. We're disclosing things that the Justice Department has in disclosing evidence, but there's no illegal activity there.
Yeah.
That is bothersome.
But it has been disclosed, and so we can't unring that bell. And your question, I guess, is should you continue to listen to this podcast? My first thought would be he can't not discuss it on his podcast, although his podcast is about a whole different topic about health and longevity and all those things. Do you know if he has publicly addressed this on the podcast?
Since the files were released, he hasn't issued any new episodes.
Oh,
so okay. The podcast has been
like a hiatus.
Yeah.
Okay. If I followed this person and like had respected his point of view about other things, and then I learned this about him, and then after this has become public, and the next episode that drops is, you know, Dr. Peter Attia discusses the recent news about him in the Epstein files, like, I would want to listen to that. I would want to get his take on that and see what it says. And I guess I would probably listen to that and then decide if that, how he framed it and what his thoughts about that were, and I'm presumably how contrite he is, would probably play into my decision about whether to continue subscribing to the podcast, whether to continue to listen to the podcast. If, like, again, hypothetically, a month from now, he starts releasing episodes again, covering all the topics he talked about before and never once mentioning this, I mean, that doesn't seem great. I mean,
So let me ask you this. So is that pretty much the same approach CBS should use in determining whether they continue to have him be a news contributor?
I think that might be a little, in my opinion, a little different. If I were in charge of CBS News, which I'm not, and we have somebody who's kind of a lightning rod now who is, I would probably, from a I would come to the conclusion pretty quickly that there are other people who probably are as good or nearly as good of being an analyst in the area he talks about. I would probably not want to be associated with someone who is so closely tied to some awful person like Jeffrey Epstein. I think I, and also I'm like paying him money, and I think that I would owe it to my network and to the employees for that news organization to say, we're not going to make you for the next year keep having to explain why you're working for a network that employs someone like this. So I think from a like business standpoint, it's probably good for CBS News to sever relationships and find somebody else for that role. But to me, that's different than like what you or I decide, because we're not, you know, if you decide to listen to him, you're not making this uncomfortable for the 500 other people who you employ.
Right. Yeah. It's just whether I think it's still worth listening to him, I guess.
Yeah. But do you think, we don't know what he's going to do, but let's say a month from now, he has a podcast, he drops a podcast. Do you think he has responsibility to his listeners to address this head on, or do you think he should just continue down the topics he had been covering and just not discuss it at all?
Oh, I think he should. I think he should address it. I think you're right. I mean, I have not unfollowed mainly because I want to see if he does drop another podcast and what he says, whether he addresses it.
And let's say he drops two or three or four more, and it's all about topics he's covered before. This issue is not covered at all. Would that change your mind about continuing to listen to him? If the shows are as good as they were before, but he's just sort of like skipped over this whole thing.
Yeah, I think I'll probably not continue to follow it. But I haven't really made up my mind. I mean, this is a genuine question.
Yeah.
What I should do. I don't think I should have because you can have a paid subscription, then you get the lengthier versions of the podcast.
Yeah.
For free, you get the short versions. I don't think it makes too much difference whether somebody follows or not to the free version of it. And I'm just curious to hear what he has to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, like, if he doesn't address it, I think I would probably say, yeah, I'm really not interested in what he says anymore.
And I think it goes without saying that if he does choose to address it, how he addresses it matters a lot too, right?
Yeah. There are some things he could say, but I believe the little bit I've heard so far is him saying, like, well, that was 10 years ago and I'm a very different person now. I don't believe those kinds of explanations. I think, you know, like, somebody, once you've reached maturity, you're pretty much the same person you were 10 years ago. You just have regret that this all came to light and like that. So that kind of explanation doesn't hold any water. He might be saying, well, I made some jokes in response to things that were said to me that I didn't initiate. Maybe he'll say something like that. I don't know. I'm really curious to hear. I'm also just fascinating by the ways in which people make public apology or public excuses. And so this is when he comes out and he makes a fuller statement, this will be really interesting.
And just to kind of close on this, we did a show, oh gosh, 6 months ago, I don't know, maybe longer, when there was the big dust up over the Coldplay concert couple, remember?
Right, who, yeah.
And there was this, you know, the CEO of this technology company and his HR representative caught in this moment and the camera showed them and they quickly stepped away and kind of tried to hide themselves and hide their faces. And I don't know if you saw it, the New York Times did a story, I don't know, a month or two ago with the woman involved there. I mean, she didn't really apologize, but it was more just about like what the hours, days, weeks, and months were like for her after that. And as you can imagine, the hours and days after that were pretty awful, right? And it sort of, you know, remind you, or if you did already know, about what being the character on the internet for the day can be like. Because in her case, I mean, it just upended and at least temporarily, and maybe more than temporarily, sort of ruined her life. And obviously, she may have made a bad decision at a moment in time, but it does show that we live in a world today, whether you're emailing with someone you probably shouldn't be, or whether you're hanging out in a public place with someone you probably shouldn't be, that there can be consequences. And sometimes I would argue consequences that maybe are above and beyond what they should be.
So here's what I would say about that in Jeffrey, in the case of Dr. Peter Attia and Jeffrey Epstein, is no matter how awful it's been since the release of the files for Dr. Attia, it's nowhere near as bad as what happened to Jeffrey Epstein's victims.
True. And that's how it's different than Coldplay.
That's what's different. Yeah. Like, we're talking about people who are real victims in this case.
Yeah.
And if it turns out, you know, I haven't gone back into the files and read the actual emails. I just read, you know, the segments of them that were quoted in the news reports. But if he's joking about these young women who are the real victims, for me, that's just inexcusable. And so whatever kind of ruination that's come to him as a result of those coming to light, well, he deserves it.
So I'm going to say something that's probably, I'm going to sound more flip than I mean it to be. You've talked almost every show about how as a society, as a community, we need to spend more time face to face with people, right?
Yeah.
One advantage of doing that, Rick, there's no paper trail. I even do know, seriously, that there are politicians who realize that if they're an elected official, their emails are public record. And there are people who will say, I'm only going to have conversations about this with you in person somewhere because I don't want to have an email record, a record that shows up somewhere, or even the chance that you're recording this. We're just going to sit face to face and have a conversation where I know that this is not going nowhere but outside of the two of us. Now, I don't want to say for a moment that we should be having, that anyone should be having conversations that they're not defensible and that they're not proud of. But that is maybe a way to think about this, is to get more people in person, is that you don't have screenshots and FOIA requests exposing all these things that you have said.
If we're concerned about privacy, it's the only way to ensure it right now.
That is true. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.